Dex and Desmond left the hotel with a confident air after their meeting with Frank and Luther, alias Claudius Turnbuckle. They turned and walked briskly down the boardwalk.
I thought that went quite well.
You might have thrown a little scare into Turnbuckle, not Morgan, though.
Morgan is nothing but a cheap gunman. If we have the law on our side...
Don't start spouting that stuff at me, O'Hara. I know you're not a real lawyer or a colonel. You're just a cheap actor and a con man.
Now, see here...
No, you listen to me. Don't start thinking that this case will ever really go to trial. I don't want to risk it. That's why Stample and his men are going to take care of the judge tomorrow. The delay that will cause ought to be enough to give them a chance to get rid of Morgan and Turnbuckle, too. With all of Woodford's allies gone and facing a formidable legal opponent like you, he won't have any choice but to give in. Then, we'll all collect our payoff.
I've actually had a considerable amount of legal training, you know. I've played attorneys on numerous occasions.
In numerous swindles, you mean?
A role is a role.
That's right. Just play your part, O'Hara. Play your part and leave the rest of it to me.
Judge Theodore Grampus was a bandy-legged man with deeply pitted eyes, a white brush of a beard, and long white hair that was seldom tamed, just jammed down under a bowler hat. He was the only passenger today in the coach that swayed along the rough trail. Grampus had been a circuit judge for many years here in Nevada, and was used to rough transportation and rougher characters. He carried an old cap-and-ball pistol under his coat, and knew how to use it if he had to.
Uh-oh! It looks like trouble up ahead, Judge.
What is it? Highwaymen?
Looks like it. They got the trail blocked in front of us.
The stagecoach was going down a hill. The trail was relatively narrow, with high banks on either side, so there was no way the vehicle could turn around. It had to go straight ahead until it reached the bottom of the slope. And waiting down there, Grampus saw, were close to a dozen armed, masked men on horseback. Stagecoach robbers.
We'll plow right through them. Can't turn back, so we might as well go straight ahead.
The driver and shotgun guard exchanged worried looks.
Judge, there's too many of them. They'd shoot us to pieces.
Oh, all right. Although it galls me to give in to lawlessness, better to turn over the mail pouch and our valuables and get on the buckskin with our lives, I suppose.
The driver hauled back on the reins even more as the stagecoach approached the bottom of the slope. The outlaws spread out so that their horses completely blocked the trail.
Stand and deliver!
Take it easy, mister. Don't go getting trigger happy. We gonna cooperate.
That's being smart. Now toss down the pouch. Anything in the boot?
Just the judge's bag.
Judge?
Grampus swung the coach door open and hopped out with a nimble spryness that belied his age.
That's right. I'm Judge Theodore Grampus, and if you varmints know what's good for you, you'll turn around and hightail it out of here right now.
Sorry, Judge, but I ain't afraid of you. We'll have your money and your watch, and anything else you got in your pockets is valuable.
You damn thief. You'll pay for your lawlessness, if not now, then someday.
Hand it over! Hand it over!
Grampus pulled his coat back and started to reach for an inside pocket where he kept his wallet.
Look out! He's got a gun!
The outlaw opened fire, as did several of the other outlaws, and Grampus was driven against the side of the coach by the series of stunning hammer blows as the lead struck him. He folded up and collapsed beside the stagecoach. The driver and shotgun guard hadn't moved. They sat there on the box, stunned by the unexpected horror of Judge Grampus's murder.
Old Coot tried to grab his gun. I reckon we better kill these guys, too.
The two men on the box threw down their guns.
Hold it, mister. Don't shoot. For God's sake, please don't shoot.
All right, boys. We won't kill them. Get the mail pouch, and then cut the leaders free, so it'll take them a while to get where they're going.
The masked man swung down from the saddle and pawed through the pockets of the dead judge, removing his wallet and watch. He opened the boot and took Grampus's carpet bag as well, tying it on behind his saddle to go through for valuables later. Meanwhile, two of his men cut the lead horses free. Then the leader of the gang hefted the judge's blood-soaked body and slung it back into the coach. Grampus's corpse sprawled on the floor between the seats as the outlaw slammed the door. Then he mounted up as his men moved their horses to the side so that the trail was open again. With shots fired over the heads of the terrified driver and guard, the outlaw sent the stagecoach on its way toward Buckskin. Under the bandana mask tied around the lower half of his face, Cy Stample's brutal mouth curved in a grin. Frank had never liked waiting around for something to happen, and Tuesday brought a couple of those instances. Phil Noonan still hadn't returned from Carson City with the replies to Turnbuckle's telegrams, and as morning turned to midday and then stretched into afternoon, the stagecoach carrying the circuit judge didn't show up on schedule. Of course, there could be any number of reasonable, innocent explanations for that, Frank told himself as he sat on the porch in front of the marshal's office, waiting. Catamount Jack sat with him.
Stagecoach should have been here by now.
Yeah, I know.
Could have had a wheel come off or lock up. Might even have broke an axle.
I suppose.
Every so often you get an avalanche that blocks the trail, too. And then the coach has got to find some other way to go around. That'll throw it behind schedule.
Sure will.
Tip Woodford came along the street and stepped up onto the porch.
Stage ain't here yet?
I haven't seen it.
Should have rolled in about an hour ago, shouldn't it?
Uh-huh.
I think it must have busted an axle.
Yeah, you're probably right.
A few minutes later, Diana walked up with Claudius Turnbuckle, whose arm was still in the black sling.
The stage is late, isn't it?
Let's give it a little longer. If it still doesn't come in, then I'll ride up the trail toward Carson City, see if I can find out what happened to it.
Brighton's men might try to ambush you again.
Oh, son of a gun. Looks like they run into trouble, all right.
The stagecoach rolled slowly into town, pulled by only two horses instead of the usual four. Frank knew that cutting the leaders free and running them off was a common tactic used by stagecoach bandits to delay a coach from getting to town and spreading the word of the robbery. Frank stepped down from the porch and moved at a fast walk toward the stage station, followed by Catamount Jack, Woodford, Turnbuckle, and Diana. The driver and shotgun guard didn't appear to be hurt as they clambered down from the box.
Bad news, Marshal. We were held up about 10 miles north of here.
Anybody hurt?
Well, that's the even worse news. Judge Grampus is in there. The outlaws killed him.
Old Grumbler Grampus dead? Lord help us. I've known him for years. Take Diana back to the office, would you, Mr. Turnbuckle? This is liable to be pretty bad.
It sure is. They blasted him plumb to pieces.
Come along, Diana. There are some things women shouldn't be forced to see.
Once Diana was gone, Frank, Woodford, and Catamount Jack stood by the door and looked into the coach at the bullet-riddled body of the elderly jurist.
Tell me what happened.
The driver and shotgun guard explained about the masked outlaws lying in wait for them at a spot in the trail where the stagecoach couldn't turn around and flee.
The judge wanted me to try to bull on through them. We convinced him it'd be loco to pull a stunt like that, though. The pool cats had us outgunned.
So you stopped. What happened then?
Well, the outlaws told us to stand and deliver. We started to throw the mail pouch down when Judge Grampus got out of the coach. The fella who seemed to be the boss of the gang told him to hand over his valuables. Then he yelled out that the judge was going for a gun and all hell broke loose.
It must have been at least a half a dozen of those bastards plugged the judge. Then they said they were going to kill us too, but they decided not to.
Frank leaned into the coach to take a closer look at Judge Grampus's body and saw the butt of the old pistol.
That was a mighty foolish play. Trying to draw on that many men who already had their guns out and ready.
Oh, you didn't hear the judge when he was yelling for us to bust right through him, Marshal. That old pelican was just spoiling for a fight.
Grumbler was like that, Frank. Never one to stand aside or take anything from anybody. Not a bit of backup in him. He was fair and honest as the day is long. I knew he wouldn't give me any favors in the court case with Brighton, but I knew Brighton wouldn't stand a chance in hell of buying him off either. He would have decided things according to the law and nothing else.
Well, he won't decide anything now. You know what that means, don't you, Tip? There won't be any trial tomorrow. You still have Brighton's claim hanging over your head.
Yeah, that's mighty bad luck. I don't see how you can blame this on Brighton, though, Frank. Stagecoach got held up, which ain't all that common, but ain't unheard of either. And Judge Grampus made the mistake of trying to fight back. Seems pretty simple to me.
Yeah, it does. There's only one thing to do now. We have to send word to Carson City and get another judge sent out.
That could take weeks.
Maybe, maybe not. The governor's liable to appoint a special judge to take Grampus's place, given the circumstances of his death and the seriousness of the case that was waiting for him here in Buckskin. There's one thing that I'm sure of, though.
What's that?
I'm gonna see to it personal-like that the next judge gets here safe and sound.
In Dex Brighton's hotel room, Brighton smiled tightly as O'Hara reported what he had just overheard on the street.
It sounds like your man Stample succeeded admirably this time. The judge is dead, the case is delayed, and everyone is completely convinced that the tragedy occurred during a simple stagecoach robbery that had nothing to do with you.
I wouldn't be so sure that Morgan is convinced. He wouldn't have lived as long as he has if he wasn't fairly smart. But as far as everyone else is concerned, there's no connection between us and the judge's death. And that's all that matters.
Perhaps this would be a good time to approach Woodford with another settlement offer. Say you allow him to retain a 10% interest in the Lucky Lizard.
All right. It won't hurt anything to try. Maybe we can avoid any more killing, at least for now. Of course, Woodford won't actually get 10%. I suspect that he'll meet with an unfortunate accident before that ever happens.
If such a tragedy were to take place, his share in the mine would go to his lovely daughter, I'm sure.
That's right. In that case, Diana Woodford would need a friend and protector, wouldn't she? I'm sure the notion would appall her right now, but under different circumstances. A woman will do what she has to in order to survive, my friend, whatever that may be.
Luther Galloway paced back and forth in the offices of the Lucky Lizard Mining Company. His wounded arm still troubled him from time to time, but not nearly as much as this new development did. Tip Woodford and Diana sat there looking dispirited, and Luther wished he could think of something to tell them that might make them feel better. They had been hoping that this whole mess might be over soon, but now, with the death of Judge Grampus, everything would be pushed back that much longer.
Marshal Morgan is correct. The governor will probably appoint a special judge to take Judge Grampus's place, and under the circumstances should see to it that the replacement is sent to Buckskin as quickly as possible. Another week, perhaps, but that should be all.
I don't know, Mr. Turnbuckle. It's starting to seem to me like I'm jinxed. Maybe Brighton's been right all along, and I'm in the wrong. Jeremiah Fulton could have lied to me about not having a partner. Maybe Brighton's claim is the real thing.
No. You can't give up. We can beat Brighton. I know we can.
Before they could discuss the matter any further, the door opened. Luther turned around to see Colonel Desmond O'Hara coming into the office. The Chicago lawyer took his hat off and nodded politely to Diana.
Miss Woodford, delightful to see you again. And you too, Mr. Woodford.
What do you want, Colonel?
I've just heard the tragic news concerning Judge Grampus. It seems to me that these changed circumstances warrant further discussion.
The circumstances haven't changed. Another judge will be sent out, and the case will proceed as planned.
Eventually, yes. But this continued controversy does no one any good, Counselor. The matter needs to be settled once and for all so that it's not hanging over everyone's head. Therefore, my client has decided to extend an olive branch to your client and offer him a percentage of the mine in exchange for full acknowledgement of the validity of the partnership agreement between Jeremiah Fulton and Chester Brighton.
He did that before, right at first. What's he offering now?
5% of the mine's profits.
5% of my own mine? By the Lord, Harry!
Please, sir, control yourself.
This is my office. I'll control myself if I damn well please.
I told him. I told Mr. Brighton that such an offer was insulting, but he insisted that I make it. However, at my urging, he agreed that if you refused the initial offer, I had the authority to double it.
That's still only 10%.
10% of the profits that your client has no legal right to whatever, Counselor. It seems like a fair offer to me.
Not to me. The Lucky Lizard is mine.
But if the judge who eventually hears the case doesn't agree with you, sir, you'll be left with nothing. Not only that, but the judge might even rule that Mr. Brighton is entitled to all the profits that have been realized from the mine up to this point.
A lot of that money went right back into the mine to expand it. It's not like I got cash in the bank.
Well, that wouldn't be Mr. Brighton's problem, now would it?
What do you think, Diana?
I don't think you should make any decisions, Pa, without talking to Frank first. And you need to talk it over with Mr. Turnbuckle here, too.
My advice to my client, Colonel, is to flatly reject Brighton's flimsy offer. There will be no settlement because no settlement is called for. My client is completely in the right, and his claim will soon be vindicated in court. The best course of action for your client would be to abandon the charade and leave Buckskin as soon as possible.
Your attorney's fiery speech is very impressive, sir. But the decision rests with you, not him. You've heard what he has to say. Now what do you say? Will you accept my client's generous offer or not?
You tell Bratton, the Lucky Lizard is mine. Always has been, ever since I bought it from Jeremiah Fulton, and always will be unless I decide to sell it to somebody myself, which ain't likely to happen.
That's your last word on the matter?
Yes, sir, it is. If it's a fight Brighton wants, then it's a fight he'll get, right to the bitter end.
Very well. I'll convey your decision to Mr. Brighton. I must say, though, that I believe you're making a grave error.
My mistake to make. So long, Colonel. I don't reckon there's any need for you to pay us another visit. The answer's still gonna be the same.
In other words, Colonel, we'll see you in court.
About an hour after the stagecoach arrived in Buckskin, carrying the body of Judge Theodore Grumbler Grampus, a knock sounded on the back door of the marshal's office. Frank was inside, pouring himself a cup of coffee from the pot that was usually simmering on the old stove, when he heard the quiet rapping. He set the coffee aside and put his hand on the butt of his Colt as he moved over to the door.
Who is it?
Phil Noonan, Marshal.
Phil grinned as he came into the office and reached under his shirt to pull out a packet of papers.
Here are all the replies to those telegrams you had me send, Marshal. Sorry it took me so long to get back here with them. That last one didn't come till late yesterday afternoon. Too late to start back then. As important as you made this whole thing sound, I figured it'd be better to wait until today rather than spending a night on the trail and taking a chance on something happening to him.
Frank took the bundle of messages, which were tied together with string. Judging by the thickness of the bundle, Claudius Turnbuckle had received a reply to every wire he had sent out, and some of them must have been lengthy.
You did the right thing, Phil. I don't know what all is in here, but Mr. Turnbuckle is expecting some mighty important information for that court case of his.
Did I get back in time for the trial? Worried about that. The judge was supposed to get here today, wasn't he?
You haven't heard what happened?
Well, I came straight here, so I haven't heard anything. What's wrong, Marshal?
The stagecoach carrying the judge arrived today, all right. But Judge Grampus was dead. He's killed in a holdup while the stage was on its way down here from Carson City.
Dead? Good Lord, Marshal. What's that mean for Tip Woodford's court case?
It's been postponed until another judge can get here.
Got any idea when that's gonna be?
Not yet. But I'm gonna ride to Carson City and bring back the next one myself, just to make sure that nothing happens to him. I know the last time I left town for a while, Catamount Jack took care of things by himself, but I'm not sure that's such a good idea. I could use an extra deputy, Phil. Are you interested in the job?
You trust me as a deputy, Mr. Morgan, when I couldn't make it as a miner?
Some men are good at some things, other men are good at different things. You've done a fine job helping me out now and then, like delivering those messages and bringing back the replies. Your health is better now, and I know that you used to be good in a scrap, because I remember you getting mixed up in the occasional saloon brawl. Can you handle a gun?
Well, not like you, I reckon, Mr. Morgan, but I can get this hog leg out without too much trouble, and I generally hit what I aim at if I don't rush too much.
That's good enough for me. I can't make any promises about wages yet, because I haven't talked to the mayor or the town council, but I reckon there's a good chance they'll go along with whatever I suggest.
Hell, if you need an extra deputy, I'd do it without any wages. Buckskin owes you a lot, Marshal. This probably wouldn't be a fit place to live if it wasn't for you. It's not just a boom town anymore. It's a real town, with law and order and everything, and thanks to you.
I appreciate that sentiment, Phil. Consider yourself hired. Come on over here to the desk. I think I got an extra badge.
Frank found the badge in a drawer and handed it to Phil, who pinned it to his vest almost reverently.
Never gave any thought to being a lawman.
I believe you'll make a good one.
I hope so. But I got a family, Marshal. Maybe I shouldn't take such a dangerous job.
Swinging a pick or working with blasting powder down in the mine is just as dangerous. You won't find anything in this world that's completely safe.
Well, no, I reckon that's true. Well, you've got yourself a deputy, Mr. Morgan.
Well, since we're going to be working together, you'd better call me Frank.
All right, Frank.
Now, I reckon I'd better get these over to Mr. Turnbuckle. I know he's anxious to see what they have to say.
Frank found Turnbuckle in the office of the Lucky Lizard Mining Company, as he thought he might. Woodford and Diana were there too, and all of them seemed upset about something. Turnbuckle explained about Colonel O'Hara's visit and the settlement offer that the Colonel had made.
It was rejected out of hand, of course. There's no need for a settlement since we're going to win in court.
Well, I got to admit that I thought about it for a second. No offense to you, Mr. Turnbuckle. Don't think for a second that I'm doubting you. It just seems like everything keeps going wrong, and I thought maybe it was time to start considering a settlement.
Maybe this'll make a difference. I just got these back from Carson City.
Turnbuckle eagerly took the bundle of papers from Frank. Since his wounded arm was still in the sling, and he had only one good hand at the moment, he fumbled awkwardly with the messages for a second before Diana came to help him.
Let me get that.
She took the bundle and began to untie the string around it. When she had the string undone, she placed the stack of telegrams on the desk and handed the first one to Turnbuckle, who was able to unfold the message form and read what was printed on it. Frank saw his eyes light up as he did so.
Let me see the next one.
Turnbuckle set that wire aside and held out his hand. For several minutes, with Diana's assistance, Turnbuckle read the replies, and the grin on his face got bigger and more excited with each one.
Yes! That's exactly what I needed to know.
Good news, I reckon.
It certainly is. My theory has been confirmed.
What theory?
I don't have everything worked out yet, and there's more information that I may not find out until the trial, so I'd prefer to keep this to myself for the time being. You understand, I hope.
Well, not really. But you're a lawyer, I reckon, so I'll go along with what you say. I figure you know what you're doing.
With any luck, you won't have to wait very long. I'm leaving for Carson City this afternoon.
Leaving? Why?
I'm going there to get a new judge and bring him back.
I assumed you'd just send a messenger to the governor.
There's no way of proving it right now, but I got a hunch Brighton might have had something to do with that so-called stagecoach robbery.
You think he had Judge Grampus assassinated?
We can't rule it out, can we?
That low-down skunk. You're right, Frank. Old Grumbler getting killed like that was one of the things that almost made me want to give up. I didn't like the idea of waiting for another judge to show up. Could be that Brighton was counting on that.
That's what I thought, too. Brighton's tried to kill me and the counselor here to put you in a deeper hole, Tip. I'm convinced of that. Delaying the trial does the same thing. He's been trying to pile so much on you that you'll collapse under the weight.
That's not gonna happen. I'll keep fighting.
And so will I. What you have to say makes a great deal of sense, Frank. But if you leave town, won't that just give Brighton the opportunity to send his hired killers after you again?
Maybe. I'll try to slip out without anybody noticing, though. And I reckon I can trust you folks not to tell anybody that I'm gone.
Of course.
People notice you're not around town, Frank.
Maybe not until I'm gone, though. Jack can pretend like I'm still here, and so can Phil Noonan. I just signed him up as an extra deputy.
Noonan's a good man. Not cut out to be a miner, but that don't mean he won't be a good deputy.
That's how I saw it, too.
You'll have to be careful, Frank. We need all the allies we can get if we're going to keep Brighton from taking over the mine.
Don't worry, I know that. If anything happens while I'm gone, find Jack or Phil. Any other wires you need sent from Carson City, Claudius?
This is all I need, providing that everything works out at the trial, which I hope will be soon.
That makes two of us, Counselor.
Frank got Catamount Jack and Phil Noonan together at his office and explained his plan to them while he packed a few supplies for the journey, after informing Jack that Phil was now a deputy too.
But I'll be in charge while you're gone, right, Marshal?
I wouldn't want it any other way, Jack. You've been working with Frank and wearing a badge for quite a while. I don't really have any idea how to be a deputy, so I've been looking to you to take charge.
Well, all right then. Didn't mean to sound proddy. I just wanted to know where we stand.
Well, now you know. Anyway, I don't intend to be gone longer than I have to. I'll ride as long as I can before it gets too dark to travel, and then start out again in the morning at first light. I ought to reach Carson City by midday. If I can get in to see the governor right away and convince him to appoint a new judge to replace Judge Grampus, maybe we can start the next morning. That'll put us back here day after tomorrow.
Assuming you don't run into any trouble, like more of them no-good bushwhackers trying to kill you.
I'm hoping I can get out of town without Brighton finding out about it right away. If I got a good enough start, Brighton's gunnies won't be able to catch up to me.
No, but once they figure out that you're gone, they can lay for you on your way back.
I reckon the judge and I'll just have to take our chances.
Could take a bunch of heavily armed men with you. You have plenty of friends here in Buckskin who would be glad to help out, Marshal.
And I won't put any of them at risk if I don't have to. Besides, one or two men can move faster and be harder to trail than a whole bunch.
Yeah, I reckon that's true, all right.
I've talked to Mr. Turnbuckle and told him to stay here in town, with lots of people around. I'm convinced that Brighton would like to see him dead, too. That'd be one more threat to his plan eliminated. But he can't afford to have Turnbuckle bushwhacked right out in the open. Keep an eye on him, though, just in case.
Don't worry, Frank. We won't let anything happen to the little fella.
With that taken care of, Frank sent Jack down to the livery stable with instructions for Amos Hillman to saddle up Stormy and bring him to the back of the marshal's office and jail in half an hour. Goldie was younger and perhaps stronger, but on a possibly perilous trek like the one he was facing, Frank wanted the more reliable Stormy as his mount. Stormy had never let him down during times of trouble and never would. Frank had the two deputies out watching for any signs of Brighton, O'Hara, or anybody else who looked suspicious when Hillman delivered Stormy in the alley behind the jail. Wolf was with them, and the big cur didn't seem bothered by anything, which Frank took as a good sign.
Thanks, Amos.
Frank hung the bag of provisions and ammunition from the saddle, shook hands quickly with the liveryman, and then swung up onto Stormy's back. He lifted the reins and sent the big stallion cantering toward the trees at the edge of the settlement. With Wolf trotting along beside him, Frank rode west from Buckskin. Leaving town in that direction was a pretty transparent attempt at subterfuge, he thought, but it might work to throw off anybody who saw him heading that way. Frank didn't start circling back to the north until he was several miles out of town. This would make the trip longer, but possibly safer. Coming back would be a different story. If he could convince the governor to appoint a new judge, and if he could convince that new judge to risk his neck by coming down here, then Frank intended to hustle back to Buckskin by the shortest, fastest route possible. Dex Brighton was sitting in an armchair in his hotel room when a soft knock sounded. He slipped his hand inside his coat and curled his fingers around the butt of the little pistol he carried there.
Come in!
He relaxed and let go of the gun as the door opened and Desmond O'Hara strolled in.
What's wrong?
Oh, you read me too well, my friend. Frank Morgan is gone.
Gone? What do you mean?
Just what I said. I was talking to Mason in the top notch a short time ago, and he said that someone told him Amos Hillman delivered Morgan's horse to him in the alley behind the jail this afternoon. That alarmed me, so I started asking around. It turns out no one has seen Morgan since that time.
Oh, damn it! He's stolen a march on us!
Maybe he just left town and doesn't intend to come back.
Not Morgan. Not that stubborn son of a bitch. He's gone to Carson City to bring back another judge. When did Morgan leave?
All I know for sure is what Mason told me. Hillman took Morgan's horse over to the jail around 4 o'clock.
That means he's had several hours' head start. Morgan's been a hunted man for most of his life. He'll know all the tricks of throwing off pursuit. Sending Stample and the others after him now would be a waste of time. They'd never catch him.
If Morgan plans to fetch another judge, he'll have to come back to Buckskin for the ploy to do any good.
Exactly. And that will be our chance to stop him. I'll have men watching all the trails into Buckskin, just in case Morgan tries to circle around and come in from another direction.
Do you have that many men?
I told Stample several days ago to send for reinforcements. They'll be coming from all over, as soon as the word gets around. With any luck, by the end of the week, I'll have between 30 and 40 men working for me.
And just how do you intend to pay them? I'm willing to work on a percentage basis because I've seen you pull off audacious schemes before, Dex. But not all of those gunmen will know you as well as I do.
They know Stample, though, and they trust him. As much as men like that trust anybody, I mean. Don't worry, Desmond. When the big payoff comes, there'll be enough loot to go around. You have my word on that.
And in the meantime?
In the meantime, since we can't do anything about Morgan until he tries to return to Buckskin, we'll rid ourselves of another obstacle. We're going to do something about Claudius Turnbuckle.
It was difficult for Luther not to share the reasons for his excitement with Woodford and Diana after he went through the replies to his telegrams, but he didn't want to get their hopes up too much just yet.
Not yet.
There were still too many things that could go wrong with his strategy, such as the fact that a great deal of it depended on information he would have to uncover during the trial. If that didn't work out, Luther preferred not to think about that. Taking the telegrams with him, he returned to the hotel and closed himself up in his room to go over them again. Luther sat at the small table in the room with some paper and a pencil and began making notes for the brief he would submit to the judge. That was assuming, of course, that Frank Morgan would be successful in his attempt to return to Buckskin in fairly short order with a jurist to hear the case. Luther was so caught up in his work that he didn't really notice time passing until the rumbling of his stomach reminded him that he hadn't eaten for quite a while. He glanced out the window and saw that night had fallen. Morgan should be well on his way to Carson City by now. Luther pushed his penciled notes away from him. He reached for his hat. He would go downstairs, get a bite to eat in the dining room, and then come back up here to work some more on his trial preparations. Luther's fingers were cramping a little from the writing he had scrawled across several sheets of paper. Because of that, his hat slipped out of his grasp and fell to the floor beside his chair. Luther bent to retrieve it. At that same moment, something crashed through the window, spraying glass over the floor and the foot of the bed. Luther had been in this frontier settlement long enough to realize that a bullet had almost parted his hair just now. Luther was still moving, so the second slug missed too. He threw himself to the floor, the jolting impact sending pain shooting through his injured arm. The blasted thing would never heal up if people kept shooting at him, he thought wildly. He rolled over a couple of times, putting the bed between himself and the window. Plastic showered down from the wall in a couple of places where it was struck by bullets. And then the lamp suddenly shattered. Blazing kerosene sprayed across the table.
No!
As the flames licked out hungrily toward the piles of telegrams and notes Luther had left there, he lunged to his feet without even thinking about the fact that he was exposing himself once more to the person who was trying to kill him. He was reminded of the danger a second later when a bullet tugged at the tail of his coat as it passed close by his hip. He was moving too fast to stop, though. He threw himself at the table and grabbed the papers. A couple of them were already burning around the edges. He slapped out the flames. The garish, madly leaping light from the fire was probably what saved him, making it difficult for the ambusher to draw an accurate bead on him. Another slug whistled past Luther's head. By now, the wall behind the table and the table itself were burning. Smoke began to fill the room, stinging his nose and throat and half blinding him. Luther used both arms, ignoring the pain in the wounded one, to clutch the precious documents to his chest as he stumbled toward the door. After what seemed like an eternity of fumbling with the knob, Luther finally managed to throw the door open and half lunged, half fell out into the corridor.
Fire! Fire!
Several hotel guests had already smelled the smoke and now came hurrying out of their rooms. Luther tripped and went to one knee, then struggled back to his feet and stumbled toward the stairs. He still had belongings in the burning room, but nothing as important as what he carried with him. People crowded around him as the other frightened guests tried to escape the blaze too. He felt a sudden pain in his side and nearly fell again. A man caught hold of his arm and steadied him as they reached the staircase.
You all right, mister?
No, can you give me a hand down to the lobby?
Sure. Now, folks gotta stick together when all hell breaks loose.
With the man's help, Luther managed to get downstairs. Buckskin had a volunteer firefighting company. Its members were rushing into the hotel as Luther and the other terrified guests were rushing out. A crowd of hotel guests and onlookers gathered in the street to watch as the firemen tried to save the place. A horse-drawn wagon filled with barrels of water careened to a halt in front of the hotel, and a bucket brigade was soon set up. Other volunteers used buckets to refill the barrels from the creek at the edge of town. The line of them stretched all along the street. Luther's head spun dizzily. He shoved the papers he had saved from the fire into his sling, then pressed his hand against his side where the pain had struck. When he pulled it away, he saw that his palm was coated with blood. It looked even more crimson than usual in the light from the fire. For a second, Luther thought he was going to pass out as he realized that he'd been wounded again. He struggled to hang on to consciousness.
Mr. Turnbuckle!
Luther recognized Tip Woodford. Close behind Woodford were Catamount Jack and another man wearing a deputy's badge. That must be Phil Noonan, Morgan's new deputy, Luther recalled.
Are you all right, Mr. Turnbuckle?
No, I don't think I am. In fact, I seem to be...
That was all he got out before his knees buckled and he felt himself falling.
Son of a gun!
Catamount Jack knelt beside the lawyer and pulled back his coat, revealing a large blood stain on Turnbuckle's shirt.
This hombre's hurt. We'd better carry him down to Doc Garland's.
Jack. Jack. Listen to me.
I'm right here, Mr. Turnbuckle. What are you trying to tell me?
Somebody shot at me. Through the window. Tried to kill me. Bullet broke the lamp.
Jack glanced toward the hotel. He didn't know if the firefighting company would be able to save the building or not, but they were already doing all they could and didn't particularly need his help. There was something else he could do, though. He could try to find the bushwhacking son of a bitch who'd taken those shots at Turnbuckle and accidentally started the fire.
Tip, grab hold of Mr. Turnbuckle here. You too, Phil. Take him down to the docks and have Garland see how bad he's hurt. From the sounds of what he told me, he may be shot again.
Shot? You mean Bratton actually tried to kill him right here in town?
That's what I figure on finding out.
Tip and Phil got hold of Turnbuckle and carefully lifted him, then started off toward the doctor's office with the wounded man between them. Jack turned to study the hotel. He knew which room was Turnbuckle's, and when he studied the window now, he saw that the glass in it was shattered. That could have been caused by heat from the fire, but it could have been caused by shots being fired through it, too, before the blaze ever broke out. Jack turned his head to look across the street. Directly opposite the hotel was Patterson's Hardware Store, a one-story building with a false front. It was closed at this time of night, which meant that somebody could have climbed onto its roof, hidden behind that false front, and shot almost straight into Turnbuckle's room.
Oh, damn it.
Jack had promised Frank Morgan that he would look after the lawyer, and then he'd let Turnbuckle sit up there like a target in a shooting gallery. Maybe he could make up for that mistake by finding the man who had done the bushwhacking. Catamount Jack drew his gun as he trotted into the dark passage next to the hardware store. He had the revolver ready as he rounded the rear corner of the building, just in case the bushwhacker was still lurking back there. He didn't see or hear anything, though. Not that he could see much in the gloom. Jack stood there, listening intently, and decided after a moment that the rifleman was long gone, if he had even used the hardware store as a shooting platform. Jack started forward, but had gone only a few steps before he nearly tripped over something. Catching his balance, he knelt and felt around with his free hand. His fingers brushed what felt like a ladder. He fished a lucifer out of his shirt pocket. The glare from the match revealed that his guess was right. A ladder lay crookedly on the ground at his feet, as if it had been propped against the building and then toppled over. Jack's eyes narrowed as he noticed that one of the rungs was broken, as if it had cracked clean in two under somebody's weight. He took hold of the ladder, raised it from its current position, and leaned it against the rear wall of the store. The broken rung was three down from the top. The bushwhacker had been on top of the hardware store. Jack was sure of it now. The man had taken his shots at Claudius Turnbuckle, then started to descend hurriedly on the ladder when the fire broke out in the hotel room. But that rung had snapped under his foot, and he had probably fallen the rest of the way to the alley, bringing the ladder down with him. Jack could see the scene in his head as clearly as if he had witnessed it with his own eyes. Except for the identity of the would-be killer, of course. He didn't know that.
I'm sure as hell gonna find out.
Jack found fresh footprints in the dirt and dust of the alley. Not many people came back here, so there wasn't the welter of prints there would have been in the street. In addition to that, the prints looked like the fellow who'd made them had been dragging one leg. That fit right in with Jack's idea about the ladder rung breaking and the bushwhacker falling. The hombre had hurt his leg. Jack began following the tracks along the alley, lighting a fresh match each time one burned out. At one time in his long life, he had done some scouting for the army, and he still knew a thing or two about trailing. He was able to follow this trail all the way to the back door of the Top Notch Saloon, a considerable distance down the street from the hotel. Jack tried the knob and found the door unlocked. He eased it open and stepped inside. He was in a darkened storeroom. Making his way carefully through the storeroom, he found the door that led to the main part of the saloon. Jack opened the door just enough to put his eye to the crack and peer through. In the narrow slice of barroom he could see from here, he spotted Mason, one of the regular bartenders, leaning on the hardwood and breathing heavily. He wasn't wearing his apron, and one of the other drink jugglers was also behind the bar. Only a couple of customers were left in the saloon because all the others had hurried out to watch the fire being fought in the hotel. Jack's gaze went to a Winchester lying on a shelf underneath the bar. He'd be willing to bet a hat that if he sniffed the barrel of that rifle, he would find that it had been fired recently.
Give me your drink.
Mason straightened and took a step toward the man, who started to draw a beer. As Mason moved, he winced in pain. He had a pronounced limp, too. Jack didn't need to see any more than that. He pulled the door open, stepped into the saloon, and pointed his gun at Mason, who was reaching for the mug of beer the other bartender had filled.
Enjoy that beer, Mason. Reckon you won't be getting any behind bars.
Mason jerked around, his mouth gaping open and his prominent Adam's apple bobbing in his scrawny neck. His hand moved instinctively toward the Winchester.
I wouldn't.
What do you want, deputy? You just can't come in here waving a gun around.
You're under arrest. That's why I got this gun on you.
Under arrest? For what?
For trying to kill Mr. Claudius Turnbuckle, and maybe for burning down the hotel. We'll have to wait and see about that one, I reckon.
Why, you crazy old coot. I didn't shoot at anybody, and I sure didn't try to burn down the hotel.
No? Then how'd you hurt your leg?
My leg's fine.
Really? Well, let's see you dance a jig, then.
Jack shifted the barrel of his gun so that it pointed at Mason's feet, and it was obvious that he was about to start shooting.
No, wait. We were unloading some barrels of beer earlier, and one of them fell on my foot. That's all that happened, I swear. Ain't that right, Smithy?
Anyway, Mason, if you didn't have anything to do with what happened to Turnbuckle, how in blazes did you know somebody shot at him? I just said somebody tried to kill him.
Let me have that beer. You said I could have it.
Go ahead.
Mason turned and reached out to take the mug from Smithy. As soon as he had it in his hand, though, he whirled and flung the full mug at Jack's head.
Oh, God damn it!
Jack ducked and almost pulled the trigger, but Smithy stood right behind Mason, and if his shot missed, it might hit the other bartender. Then Mason grabbed the Winchester and swung it up, and Jack didn't have any choice. The heavy revolver bucked and roared in his hand. The Winchester went off too, but the bullet plowed harmlessly into the floor, while the bullet from the deputy's gun shattered Mason's right shoulder. Mason slumped back against the bar.
Don't try nothing, Smithy.
The other bartender backed off, hands raised to shoulder level.
Oh, this is none of my business, deputy. Whatever Mason did, I didn't have anything to do with it. We just work here together in the saloon.
You didn't see him talking to anybody tonight?
Hell no! He was off work tonight. I didn't even see him until he came limping in out of breath with that rifle. He told me to keep my trap shut and act like he'd been here all evening. And I knew right then he'd been up to something no good.
Come on, you blasted bushwhacker. We'll get the doctor to patch you up, and I'm going to lock you up until the marshal gets back. Frank Morgan will know what to do with you.
Goddamn old coot. The hell with you.
They moved through the bat wings onto the boardwalk.
I'm gonna bleed to death. You killed me.
No, you ain't. You're gonna stay alive to tell me the name of the varmint who paid you to get rid of Turnbuckle.
Flame suddenly spewed from the shadows at the corner of the building. Jack let go of Mason and twisted around, flinging himself to the planks of the boardwalk as more shots erupted. He triggered twice, aiming at the spot where he had seen the muzzle flashes. As the echoes of the shots faded, Jack caught the sound of rapid footsteps. He surged upright and ran to the corner, stopping just short of it and pressing his back against the wall of the building. Then he darted around the corner in a low crouch and swept the gun from side to side, searching for a target. The passage beside the top notch was empty. That became obvious a moment later when Smithy emerged from the saloon carrying a lantern.
What happened out here? Deputy, you all right?
Yeah. No thanks to the polecat who took some shots at Mason and me.
Jack looked on with disgust as the light from the bartender's lantern washed over the sprawled form on the boardwalk. Mason's eyes were wide open and stared sightlessly toward the street. A worm of blood crawled from the black-rimmed hole in his head, just below the right temple.
Lord, he's dead!
Yeah, and I never seen a dead man yet who could talk.
Dex Brighton leaned against the rear wall of a darkened building a couple of blocks away and caught his breath. He opened the cylinder of his gun and thumbed in fresh cartridges to replace the ones he had fired. Black hate filled his mind. Mason had gotten what he deserved, but it would have been nice if he could have gotten rid of that meddling deputy, too. And now Brighton had been forced to get his own hands dirty. He hated that. Killing didn't bother him all that much. He had done it in the past when necessary, but he greatly preferred to have other people do it for him. Things were just neater that way. He had known he was taking a chance when he hired Mason to kill Claudius Turnbuckle. The bartender wasn't a professional gunman by any means. Brighton had talked with him enough to know, though, that Mason was greedy and would do just about anything if the price was right. And having lived on the frontier, Mason had some experience with guns, enough so that he should have been able to hit Turnbuckle at that range. But as soon as Brighton had seen Turnbuckle in the second floor corridor of the hotel as the guests fled from the fire, he knew that Mason had failed. Turnbuckle was still alive. And by some absurd twist of fate, Mason had managed to start a fire in the hotel instead of killing the lawyer. Brighton had seized the opportunity to slip up behind Turnbuckle in the crowd. The little dagger that Brighton carried in a sheath strapped to his forearm under his sleeve had come out, and all it should have taken was a quick thrust into Turnbuckle's spine from behind. No one would even know the lawyer had been stabbed until he collapsed. Someone else in the mob had jostled Brighton's arm just as he struck, however, and even though he'd felt the blade go into Turnbuckle's body, he didn't know if it was a fatal wound or even a serious one. Once again, luck had turned against Brighton at the last second. A few minutes later, out on the street, he had seen Turnbuckle collapse. Tip Woodford and a man Brighton hadn't seen before had picked him up and carried him off, no doubt to the local doctor's office. Catamount Jack had started prowling around like he was looking for something, and it didn't take any great leap of logic to figure out what it was. Brighton had known right then that he had better get to Mason as soon as possible. The incompetent bastard wasn't at his shack on the edge of town, though, which was where Brighton had met with him before. That left the top notch, and Brighton headed for it right away. He hadn't reached the saloon in time to stop the deputy from trailing Mason there. In fact, as he glanced through the front window, Brighton had seen Jack pushing an obviously wounded Mason toward the entrance. Brighton didn't even have to think about what he did next. He knew that Mason wouldn't keep his mouth shut. He might have even talked already and implicated Brighton in the attempt on Turnbuckle's life. But as Mason and Jack pushed through the bat wings onto the boardwalk, Brighton had heard the exchange between them from where he had crouched in the shadows at the corner of the building. That had been enough to tell him that Mason hadn't spilled his guts yet. And all it took to make sure that he never would was a quick, accurate bullet to the brain.
I've come too far to give up now. I'm going to leave Buckskin a rich man, no matter how many people have to die.
Catamount Jack came into Doc Garland's office and found Claudius Turnbuckle stretched out on the medico's examination table, apparently unconscious. Tip Woodford and Phil Noonan stood by, watching anxiously. Garland glanced up from the long gash in Turnbuckle's side that he was stitching together.
Is he gonna live?
Oh, undoubtedly. Mr. Turnbuckle has a pretty messy cut in his side, but it's not going to kill him.
Wait a minute, Doc. You say he's cut?
That's right.
Garland stepped aside so that Jack could get a better look at the wound, which appeared to be a fairly deep but nice clean slash.
That's not a bullet hole.
No, it was made with a knife or some other sort of sharp-edged instrument. From the looks of it, though, I really think it was a knife.
I figured he was shot.
Not this time.
What's going on, Jack? How come you were so sure Mr. Turnbuckle would have a bullet hole in his hide?
Because Mason, that no-account bartender from down at the top notch, bushwhacked him from the roof of Patterson's hardware store across the street from the hotel.
Jack spent the next few minutes explaining about what he had found behind the hardware store and how he had trailed Mason to the saloon and confronted him there.
Somebody hired him to gun down the counselor there. And by somebody, I mean that skunk Brighton. Mason would have admitted that too, I reckon, if somebody hadn't put a bullet in his head.
And by somebody, you mean Brighton again?
That's what I'm thinking. Can't prove it, though. Brighton saw to that.
What about the hotel? Do they have the fire under control yet, or is it gonna burn down?
I stopped by there on my way here. The fire's out. Burned a couple of rooms pretty bad, including Mr. Turnbuckle's. But they got it put out before the whole hotel could burn up. My guess is that while Mason was throwing lead through the window from across the street, one of his shots hit the lamp and busted it. That'd be enough to start the fire.
Makes sense to me. But that knife wound in Mr. Turnbuckle's side don't.
I can think of one explanation.
Well, don't keep it to yourself, Doc.
I imagine there was quite a crowd in the hallway when everyone was trying to get out of the hotel. Someone could have come up behind Mr. Turnbuckle in all the confusion and stabbed him without anybody noticing.
Bratton's got a room in the hotel.
Yeah. Son of a bitch hired Mason to kill Turnbuckle. Then, when he saw that the counselor was still alive, he made a try for him his own self. Well, that didn't work either, so he went after Mason to cover his trail.
You can't prove any of it, though. Brighton's still in the clear as far as the law's concerned.
Frank told me to keep Turnbuckle alive, and it's just pure luck that he is. But I reckon we ought to look on the bright side.
There's a bright side to this mess?
Yeah. At least the whole damn town didn't burn to the ground. Think how bad it'd be if Frank came back from Carson City to find that.